History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Today I'm speaking with author Jerome Priestler, author of the book Civil War Commando, William Cushing, and the daring raid to sink the ironclad CSS Albemarle. The Albemarle was called the Terror of the Roanoke. It was an innovative war machine that seized control of the Roanoke River Valley and threatened to cost the Union the war. Cushing's attack on the Albemarle was called the greatest feat of arms in American military history. Will Cushing and his team used groundbreaking naval tactics that not only saved the presidency of Abraham Lincoln and helped the Union win the war, but also became the foundation of the modern-day Navy SEALs and the type of commando raids that are done today. The Civil War is responsible for a lot of military innovations that were vital for later wars, like using aerial reconnaissance, logistics using trains, and even canned foods. But most people don't think of commando raids as part of this list of innovations. Well, it is. So there's a lot of fascinating things to unpack here, and I hope you enjoy this discussion with Jerome Priestler. Jerome, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
All right, well, I'm really excited to talk about this, this commando raid in the Civil War. But there's one very interesting thing that I have to get into before we get into this whole story about Cushing. He was the inspiration for Luke Skywalker, some people say. So I'd love to hear how people make that connection.
Well, what happened was Edgar Rice Burroughs, who wrote the, you know, the, of course, it's most famous for Tarzan, but also wrote a number of science fiction, early science fiction fantasy novels, was a familiar acquaintance with one member of the Cushing family. And this, as the story went, it was George Lucas, I believe it, either reading an article or getting to know one of the Cushings later on, because the family is still around and active on many fronts, found out about Will Cushing's mission to destroy the CSS Albemarle, which was a Confederate ironclad that was menacing Union naval forces off the Virginia coast. There was a real comparison. There's kind of an obvious analogy between this great steel-plated monstrosity to the Death Star. And I remember before reading the book, I read an article, actually a couple of articles that were dated back a few years, which drew the connections between Lucas and the Cushing family, and Burroughs. And that, in fact, is said to have inspired Star Wars. And if you look at the story, or at least that aspect of Star Wars, you know, Luke being the commando warrior, Death Star, which Cushing was, the Death Star being, the CSS Albemarle.
Okay, well, I'll love to get into the story and hear how many parallels there are if the Albemarle had a weak point and a vent or an escape hatch like the Death Star did, and if Cushing also had such good reflexes that some would think that he had the Force. So can't wait to get into this. But I'd like to set this...
In fact, have a weak point.
Okay. All right. Well, this is surprising. I've heard about Lucas's influences, the Seventh Samurai and Japanese cinema, but not this particular thing. So one thing I'd like to know for context is, let's begin with the Albemarle. I've looked at a little bit of Civil War naval history, but I didn't know about this particular ironclad. So what was it, and why was it such a powerful weapon for the Confederacy and so many menacing to the Union?
Well, you know, before I started writing Civil War Commando, I was kind of surprised to realized that a lot of people weren't aware of the naval element of the Civil War, elements of the Civil War. So I started doing some research, and just giving it a little context, prior to the ironclads being developed, all naval battles were done by wooden occurred between wooden ships. The first ironclads were developed by the Europeans in the early to middle part of the 19th century. And during the Civil War, the Southern Secretary of the Navy, Stephen Mallory, who before assuming that role was a member of the Senate and was on various naval subcommittees, became very interested in using ironclads because he realized with some foresight that eventually they were going to supplant wooden ships, and that wooden ships were no match for warships made of iron. So early on in the Civil War, he began looking for ways to acquire or build ironclads, and he sent representatives to Europe to try to buy some. He had others looking to try and develop ironclad warships and build them from scratch, or use existing ships that could be kind of retooled into ironclads. The North lag behind in that, although they quickly began to catch up in their efforts. So the ironclad, and specifically the CSS Albemarle, a 160-foot ram, and the reason it was called a ram is that's literally what it would do. It, besides having being completely encased in iron armor, the front of the vessel came to a long kind of tusk-like projection that would be used to crash through a ram wooden vessel, and it did that pretty easily. As a result, it was extremely difficult for wooden ships to either defend against it or to attack it. And at one point in the Civil War, and we can get this a little bit more later, the Albemarle essentially was preventing all sorts of Union blockade efforts all along the Virginia and Carolina coast, and really needed to be defeated. It had destroyed a number of Union vessels that attempted that, and they needed to find a way in, and Will Cushing became the way.
In terms of technological or the arms race on the navies between the Union and the Confederacy, was the Albemarle more advanced than what the Union had in terms of its naval vessels?
I think it was probably on par. I just don't think the Union had actually gotten to the point where they really knew how to use the ironclads and deploy them. And they also had different issues, and there were a lot of problems in building these vessels. So advanced is probably not the word, but it functioned better. Put it that way.
Well, now I'm curious about William Cushing. He's described in your book as the Navy's first commando. So what does this mean? What does it mean to be a commando in the 19th century during the Civil War? And what is it about him that's special that makes him the first commando?
Oh, boy. Where do we start? Will Cushing was a person who, early in his naval career, and just to kind of give you a sense of Will, he was 19 years old between 18 and 19 years old, when most of the action in Civil War Commando takes place. And even though obviously it's times were different, that's still pretty young for a guy who had by the time he attacked the Albemarle had attained a tremendous reputation in the Navy. How did this reputation come about? At one point in the Civil War, the Union Navy instituted the blockade against Southern shipping. This was in order to prevent the South from sending necessary supplies and weapons from one place to another. It initially was limited, and these efforts were limited in their success primarily because if you look at the coastline of North Carolina, the Virginia, and so on, you're seeing a coast that's full of inlets, really very narrow waterways that the southern blockade runners were very familiar with, not so much the northerners. The initial tactics that the North used was to take a big warship and have it hover off the coast and try to intercept southern vessels as they were making their movements. However, when you had with the southerners using small crafts and knowing all the ins and outs, they were able to easily elude the northern blockade. Will's mentor, and we should talk about him again later on, a guy named Charles Flusser, who was Will's instructor at the Naval Academy. And Will was not a good student at the academy. He had disciplinary problems. He was actually thrown out of the academy at one point, which was kind of hard to do or to accomplish. The only person that Will respected at the academy really was Flusser. And Flusser was an old sea dog, and Will looked at him as someone who had seen battle before, who'd been out to sea, and really took to him for that reason. Flusser was the first person who began perfecting these, what he would call cutting out expeditions. And what he would do is take defeat the southern blockade runners at their own game. He would take small vessels into these inlets. Flusser had been a cartographer for the U.S. government, and he also was raised in some of the areas, in some of these areas. So he knew, he had firsthand knowledge of these waterways. He would take small vessels into the same inlets that the southerners were using and raid their ports, burn down their ships, intercept them before they could actually make it out into open waters, and so on. Will eventually learned from Flusser, and Will, being very bold, kind of daring person, took Flusser's tactics a step further. So toward 1863 and 1864, Will began to launch a rapid sequence of raids against southern ports, southern towns, using these commando tactics, where he would sneak in with a small group of men, he would raid villages and get out very quickly. And that was really the genesis of these sorts of tactics by the U.S. Navy. It also served Will in the end, at least when he undertook to destroy the Albemarle.
Yeah, so let's talk about the actual plans. How did the plans come together to destroy the Albemarle? Who was involved with it? I'm guessing Flusser was. At some point, they decide that Will is the right man for the job. So how did these plans come together?
Well, just to back up a second, because this is a really great part of the story. Early on, several months before Will's expedition, Flusser had undertaken his own effort. Flusser was in charge of a blockading squadron, and he undertook to destroy the Albemarle himself. He knew through different means of intelligence, he knew the Albemarle would be coming to attack Plymouth in April of 1864. So Flusser set a trap. And his idea, which was kind of wild in itself, was to wait for it using two or three large wooden ships with chains stretched between them. And what he was planning was to lure the Albemarle into this chain that would then entangle it and then give him his ships an opportunity to attack it and blow it out of the water. Obviously, it would be largely immobilized, at least if things worked out. Due to reasons of expedience, he ended up not using a chain, but using ship's line, the sort that would be used to raise sails. Probably not the best idea. What ended up happening was the Albemarle did end up getting lured into the trap. However, the trap backfired. There was this whole wild battle in which the ships were flung all over the place. The Albemarle ends up just feet away from the ship that Flusser was on. Flusser got behind a cannon and actually shot a cannonball directly at the Albemarle from about 10 feet away. The cannonball bounced off the Albemarle back onto Flusser's vessel and killed Flusser and another man that Flusser was with. And so Flusser died. Months later, Will, who had sworn vengeance, was asked if he could formulate a plan. So along with several others, he, the Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Wells, and some of the admirals had bounced different versions of a plan around. Ultimately, they decided that it would need to be done by a small craft, and it would have to be done in this commando-style fashion. Since Will had already proven many times over that this was his forte, he was asked to participate both in the planning and the development of the kind of boat that they would use to accomplish this. Will traveled to New York to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, where different types of experiments were going on in terms of developing small raiding craft. And there was kind of almost a mad scientist sort of guy there who had figured out a way to rig small 30-foot long picket boats. And just to explain what a picket boat was, the term picket essentially meant scout or sentry. So a picket boat was a small boat that would be used to sit offshore and alert people on the shore to the approach of warships. Just as pickets on foot would do the same by patrolling certain areas on land. So what they did was take a small picket boat and rig what they called a torpedo to the front of the boat. And again, to explain this, we think of a torpedo obviously as something now that's fired from a submarine. What the torpedo was then was essentially a bomb, and it wasn't fired from a vessel. It was to be connected to the front of the vessel. So, this small boat, the boat would then ram the bomb against whatever it was going to attempt to blow out of the water, and hopefully accomplish that. When Will was in New York, he spent a number of weeks actually developing so they called this a spar torpedo. He spent a lot of weeks in New York developing the vessel with this other guy, testing it out in the Hudson River. And one of the things that Will came up with that was key to the eventual success of his raid was to create a setup that allowed him to raise and lower the spar using various rope controls. The reason that was so critical and the reason that was so ingenious was that the Albemarle was known to have, here we go to our Death Star weak spot. There was a weak spot in the Albemarle right where the part of the hull that was submerged met the ironclad upper portion of the ship. That was determined to be the weakest spot for kind of obvious reasons. It was where the iron met the wood. And in order for the spar torpedo to be effective, it couldn't be used against the armored portion of the vessel. It had to go below the armor. So for Will to do that, and this had to be done very quickly because you didn't know what the depth of the water would be. You didn't know exactly what portion of the Albemarle would be submerged at a given time. Will had to be able to raise and lower the spar in order to have his torpedo make contact with this weak spot. So that was one of the great innovations here. And that, again, just to get back to your question, is part of why we call Will a commando.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. All right. So this is the plan. They're really doing some experimental stuff here. How does it actually go down? Tell me about the actual raid itself or the actual mission itself.
Well, there were a lot of obstacles, last-minute obstacles. There were I forget the actual number. I don't know if it was four or five of the picket boats were fitted, but one of them was leaky. Another one had some problems along the way, so Will is left with two picket boats with which to accomplish the mission. And it was called off one night because of bad weather. This was in the fall. It was end of October, 1864. The weather was rainy and foggy. Second night, the weather was somewhat better, although there was a heavy fog on the water. And Will set out on this mission with about 24 volunteers. And they all assumed they were going on a suicide mission. In fact, before the mission, when he was asking for volunteers, he made it very clear, look, I don't think any of us are going to survive. So if you're willing, step forward. And so they set out on these two picket boats. They start moving toward Plymouth. They're in Plymouth Harbor, which is fairly narrow. And this is done under cover of darkness. However, there were sentries all along both sides of the river. In addition, in an interesting and dramatic twist, one of the ships that Flusser had used in his attempt to trap the Albemarle was sunk in front of where the Albemarle was anchored. Because the water was low, there were actually Southern sentries or pickets, but in this case, pickets meaning men, standing atop the carcass of this sunken ship, behind which the Albemarle sat in the water. So in order for Will to... I'll back up a moment. So as Will approaches, he, first of all, some dogs start to bark. These dogs on shore, obviously, they alert the sentries that I was just talking about. The sentries begin to light fires in order to warn the troops further along the harbor that someone's approaching. And at this point, gunfire erupts from both shorelines, and Will knows they're in trouble. He leads his men forward. They continue to approach. They get to this sunken carcass of the ship that the Albemarle had sunk in the battle, and there are men atop it firing at them. One of the ships stays back to try to engage these men, while Will Pat actually goes around it and continues toward the Albemarle. In front of the Albemarle, there's another barrier of sunken logs, again, used as a defense against anyone coming to attack it. And what Will does is, there was a steam engine. They also had, actually, I probably should have mentioned this, they also had put steam engines on these small boats so that they could attain some speed. Will orders his men to go full throttle or full speed ahead. They actually go flying over the top of the wooden logs, come down in the water right in front of the Albemarle, and now they're being fired at from the Albemarle, from the shore. Will has part of his coat torn off by gunfire. He tells his men to dive because he assumes they're all going to die. So they all abandon ship and go diving into the water. Will, alone with the rope controls to his spar torpedo in his hands, lowers the spar to the level of the weak spot and goes full on into the Albemarle and dives off the boat just as the explosion occurs. In fact, a huge hole is blown into the Albemarle and it begins to sink. And Will finds himself in the water, still under fire from shore, from the sinking Albemarle, and in the night, with his men scattered in the harbor, trying to swim for shore.
Well, this is a big deal. So it's sunk. What's it like in the immediate aftermath? I mean, is this a huge turning point for the Union? I mean, does this affect what's blockaded and how they can move vessels around?
Yeah, backing up just a little. If you look at the broader picture of the war at that time, it had become a long, bloody war of attrition. And Lincoln was really, President Lincoln was under a great deal of pressure from the public and from political circles to try to find a resolution and try to end the war. Grant had engaged at this point in the war. Grant's forces were engaged in a number of spots throughout the country. There were long sieges. There were very little progress seemed to be being made. And Lincoln really needed something that was going to inspire the public. He needed a victory. That was kind of from the moral standpoint. From the more tactical, practical standpoint, while the Albemarle was guarding Plymouth, that very strategic harbor was shut off to the, it was closed off to the Union, and it was also allowing the South to run supplies back and forth along the river without any great impediment. So after getting to the aftermath of the attack, it was a huge public relations victory for Lincoln. In fact, afterward, Lincoln met with Will Cushing in person, and Will was awarded a presidential citation. He was credited for being the hero of the war, because that really allowed Union to retake Plymouth and to really launch attacks on southern blockade running again. So it was a huge turning point in the war from both a naval perspective and from a moral perspective. Afterward, Will became a kind of national celebrity and would go from place to place giving talks about what happened. And he was, you know, it was in all the newspapers. He became guest of honor at banquets and so on.
So I would like to know Cushing's legacy. So for Will Cushing, you mentioned in your book that his tactics inspired modern day Navy SEALs. How did he do that?
Well, I think that was the first time that these sorts of small scale raids against large scale forces and opponents were employed by the Navy. And if you go forward and look at what we, you know, the sort of tactics we use, the Navy SEALs use, they're really directly inspired isn't the word, but they were certainly the tactics that they use were originated by Will Cushing, not only by the Albemarle attack. Important in terms of the book that I wrote, his raid to sink the ironclad is the last two chapters of the book. And so Will's overall tactics against the South, his cutting out expeditions, his raids were really the groundwork for what would become commando style naval attacks. Again, as currently practiced by the Navy SEALs. So I think it's important not just to look at the attack on the Albemarle, although that's dramatic and it's great and it's the highlight of his military career. I think that the year or two before that are also really important.
It's good to see where this all begins, and this all begins in a very different time and place in the Civil War, which birthed a lot of the naval technologies and strategies we have today. So there's a lot to unpack here, and I'm sure much, much more to unpack in your book. And the name of the book is Civil War Commando, William Cushing and the Daring Raid to Sink the Ironclad CSS Albemarle. Jerome, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, well, that is all I have to say for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Dalton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Dalton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged, and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.